The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is a great way to stay on top of the latest news from China in just a few minutes a day, with a truly excellent free email newsletter, an equally great smartphone app, and of course at the revamped website at subchina.com. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, and I am in Manhattan today along with SubChina Editor-in-Chief Jeremy Goldkorn, where we are joined by our friend Joan Kaufman. Joan is the director for academics of the Schwarzman Scholars Program in Beijing. Before that, and before she left Beijing, just before I did, you left just before I did, right, Johnny?
Yeah, I left in spring of 2016.
Yeah, okay, yeah, so just before I did. So you were the director of Columbia University's Global Center for East Asia, as well as a lecturer at Harvard University, which you've been doing, so you're still doing that, right?
Yeah, I've been doing that since 2003.
Wow. Oh, she's one of those people with a long and storied career in China that dates way back to the early 1980s, working as program officer with the United Nations and for many years in China with the Ford Foundation. Joan, thanks so much for making the time, and great to finally have you on the show.
Yeah, I'm so happy to be here with two of my favorite people, Kaiser and Jeremy.
Well, thank you, Joan. In the interest of full disclosure, listeners, I need to mention that Joan is on our SubChina advisory board.
Yes, yeah. And delighted to be part of that fabulous new venture.
Thank
you. So now we've promoted ourselves.
Right.
Let's
get on with the show. So we have a lot to talk to you about today, about the Schwarzman Scholars Program for sure, but also more broadly about the state of U.S. educational institutes and their efforts in China, because, you know, these run the gamut from smaller centers in Beijing or other cities up to full programs with substantial campuses that are co-invested with local governments, you know, like the Duke Kunshan program and NYU Shanghai, probably most famously. We also want to talk to you about China's new NGO law, because, you know, you're somebody with really extensive NGO experience in China. They get your take on the law and whether the fear that it has generated with some of the institutions behind these programs in China is, in fact, warranted.
But before we get to that stuff, we'd really like to coax some stories out of you, Joan, from your early days in China. You started off, like many people of your generation, basically a lefty American armchair socialist type, if I understand correctly. And you were quite sympathetic to Mao's revolution and even to the Cultural Revolution. Is that correct?
You were from Berkeley, right?
Yeah, well, I have to confess, I used to refer to myself as a cappuccino and croissant socialist from Berkeley who arrived in China in 1980 and thought the Cultural Revolution was a good thing.
Wow.
So I was, you know, the Han Suyin U.S.-China Friendship Association generation. And, you know, I got to China and was pretty quickly disavowed of my positive feelings about the Cultural Revolution after sharing an office with my UNFPA colleagues. After about 3 months and hearing their horror stories, the light bulb started going on. So
yeah, it doesn't take long. So my dad went for the first time in 75, but he was sort of on the narrow kind of the Potemkin Village tour, right?
So he wasn't disabused of his.
No, not right away, but the next time he went back and he was a little more on his own, I mean, right away, he just sort of saw what was behind the veneer, right? So, yeah, wow. Let's hear more about that. So what finally substantially disabused you of your crazy lefty Berkeley notions?
Well, you know, I was there that fall. It was the trial of the Gang of Four. And,
Oh, wow. So that's 78, right?
No, it was 80.
Oh,
it was the trial of the Gang
of Four,
which was televised. Everybody was just glued to the TV set. And, after that trial and they were sentenced, you could just sort of feel that collective sigh of relief and the kind of opening feeling, you know, that forward moving feeling that I felt in China for most of the years that I was there. you know, that things were moving forward and putting the past to some degree behind. So, yeah, it didn't take long before I kind of, you know, came to my senses and understood history a little bit more accurately.
And like all Chinese people, started to Wang Qian Kan.
No, not Jody. So you were there with UNFPA, right? There was one great story I remember with your going away party that cold winter day in Hutong. You told a great story that I've shared with other people. I just want to make sure that I'm getting it right, though. So UNFPA, the United Nations Population Fund, and it had something to do with condom factory, if I could remember.
Absolutely. Well, I was just a young thing, you know, this young hippie from Berkeley, and I did kind of, you know, get with the program. UNFPA had, you know, started in China in 79, along with the other UN agencies invited in by Deng Xiaoping, and I was one of two, and it was a very small staff for the UN system there, and my boss was away, so I was delegated to go officiate at the ribbon cutting at the condom factory, and I really was this young thing, and I kind of held it together. I have to say it was a pretty funny thing, but you know, we had helped bring in this, you know, supposedly, you know, state-of-the-art technology for a condom dipping line, and so we went out to go look around at
this
thing.
So they're dipped.
They're dipped in the
vat
of
latex.
Oh, so it's like a latex
vat.
Right, okay. Yeah.
So this penis-shaped thing
absolutely.
Is dipped.
Absolutely. Okay. And, you know, I had a photo of that at the going away party. We collected all those old photos from the 80s.
That was great.
And I had a picture of the alienated labor of the little old ladies who were, like, rolling the condoms off the formers of the dipping line after they came out of the dryer after being dipped in, you know, the latex. So
right.
I managed to not laugh, and I thought that was pretty good. And then there was the kind of quality control portion of it where they were dropped in a kind of vat, and then these little old ladies would pick them up and put them on these formers again that had air holes in them and blow some air through them. And if air, you know, blow
right,
air
right.
through it. And if air came out, a light bulb would go on. And somewhere in the course of the quality control demonstration, they realized that the light bulb was burnt out. So, you know, it was just, the whole thing was so comical. But I did keep it together. But then we were in the final reception where, you know, after this whole thing, and I was shaking the hand of the lead person from the China side there, and he handed me his card, and I swear it said something like this. It might not have been exactly it. It said something like leading member, rubber industry. And I just... I just lost it. I mean, I was not your self-respecting UN official. I just could not. I started giggling, and then
it was all over. There was some really like cruel and deeply humorous person who actually translated it. So, oh yeah, this is how you translate that title.
Anyway,
I'm sure that's what really, really happened.
Yeah.
Didn't you undergo some pretty major surgery at one point in a remote part of China? Can
yes,
you tell us that
yes,
story?
Yes, you're getting all the highlights of my China experience here. 10 years later, 1993, I was traveling to China. At that point, I'd gone back, finished my PhD at Harvard, was a, you know, China researcher working in public health. And I was, you know, in Kunming for a project and on my way to two really remote rural areas where we were doing a study of some sexy topic like reproductive tract infections. And I had just given birth to my first daughter, my first child, who was, you know, I'd left in Boston for this trip. And I got a really bad stomach ache and, you know, decided not to leave for the countryside with my colleagues from Kunming Medical College until the next morning. And I ended up spending the night in a broom closet at the first affiliated hospital of Kunming Medical College.
Literally a broom closet.
Yeah, they didn't want to admit me because I was a foreigner. But then when they finally realized that I had appendicitis,
oh, that's what it was.
Yeah,
oh,
they admitted me to the, you know, Gaoji Gambu ward up on the top floor. And I called Mark, my husband, for permission to get the surgery on the cell phone of the hospital president. And my colleagues from my research study came in to reassure me. And, you know, one of them said, oh, don't worry. I had my appendix out here and I'm fine. And she lifted her skirt and I had a Frankenstein scar from like one end of her body to the other. And I thought, oh, crap.
Oh, no, that's when they sawed me in half, actually. Oh, my gosh.
So I just said to the surgeons, you know, please. please don't give me a big scar. He said something, oh, don't worry, our hands are smaller than your Western surgeons. And then the last thing I remember was entering the operating room with the windows open. And
oh, my God.
But I had no time to go anywhere else. So I had my appendix out in Kunming in 1993, and I was fine, no problems.
You're still with us,
yeah. The hospital bill was pretty funny, though, because it just, reflected the distorted pricing structure of the, broken down healthcare system, where I paid an exorbitant amount of money for the food and a small amount of money for the surgery. It was crazy.
Yeah, better than the other way around. I mean, how much can they really charge you for the food? Yeah, it used to be crazily inexpensive. For years, I had never left a hospital without paying more than like 10 kwai.
Socialism has its good points.
I spent a lot of time trying to explain that bill to my medical insurance company.
Hey, cynical listeners, are you all getting good sleep? Because that is really important. Can't say enough about how important it is. Sleep is the great panacea.
Indeed. Even insomniacs like me who have phone calls with Beijing at 2 a.m. my time need to get good sleep, which is why we are delighted to tell you about our new supporter, Casper.
Casper, indeed. Casper is the mattress company that is revolutionizing an industry that's long been dominated by just a few big overpriced brands. Casper is doing this by selling only online with free shipping to your door in a how-did-they-do-that-sized box.
Full disclosure, Kaiser and I are still waiting for Casper to actually send us their mattresses.
Uh-huh.
So Casper, if you're listening, please put it in priority mail. But we are looking forward to receiving the mattresses after checking out the huge numbers of satisfied reviews online. And we're not kidding. You can actually check out the satisfied reviews online. I did not actually know that people could get so excited by a mattress.
Neither did I, but I am totally psyched to see why. I'm really very, very excited to try memory foam for a mattress. I've been doing the memory foam pillow, and it's just been terrific. So please check out Casper, our new sponsor. Go to www.casper.com/supchina and use the promo code SUPCHINA, that's SUPCHINA, all one word, for $50 off your purchase of a Casper mattress.
If you sleep well, dear listener, you will be happy. If you buy a Casper mattress, our sponsor will be happy. And so will we.
Yes, we will be. And on the off chance that you don't like your Casper mattress, after a 100-day money-back guarantee period, you can just return it for free, including pickup. No springs attached. See what they did there?
Now on with the show.
John, you spent many years working for the Ford Foundation in China, and the Ford Foundation is perhaps the quintessential foreign NGO or non-governmental organization in China. But that was during the aughts when things were relatively liberal. I'd like to shift now and talk about how many programs, whether NGOs or academic programs, how they've fared during the last 8 years or so in this rather less liberal period. Because I think you bring very valuable perspective. Perhaps we can start by talking about these academic programs. When did they really get started in China and who pioneered them?
Yeah, well, I think the whole kind of global university thing really got off the ground with Yale and Richard Levin's 2005 paper on the internationalization of Yale. He really got the Ivies on, thinking about it and set the stage, I think, for a first, really important major university to start thinking, why should the university work globally? What's the rationale? And pretty much every other university followed suit. And then not just in China, but, around the world, NYU with the various campuses in the Middle East and in China. And, in China, I would say the Hopkins Nanjing Center was really the first collaboration, but that was really for a graduate program. Most of the other universities, including Columbia, where I was working, really took on the global agenda, really thinking about what is a global university? Why is it important to prepare our students to work globally in a globalized world? What does that mean? What's the meaning of co-equal knowledge where it's not just generated in the North? And, and how do you pull together the various threads of different parts of the university working on international areas? Some parts of the university always work globally and do a lot of global research. How do you pull it together in a meaningful way and create a rationale around it, which many universities are doing now?
So what are the ultimate goals of these university programs? I mean, presumably there are, a bunch of different goals. There's intellectual and academic goals. I guess more practical business goals as well, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the noble goals, the intellectual and academic goals are really about, you know, how do you train global citizens and faculty who can teach them? And how do you, you know, absolutely create a kind of a global knowledge base or knowledge generation enterprise, which then can come back and be part of the educational material on the campus? And also, how do you engage on global issues outside of, you know, North America in a sense? And how do you create discussions and open discourse on important global issues around the world, in a world that where you need, you know, the world to solve it, not just, you know, the major universities
in
the West.
So these are the noble goals. I mean, so presumably there are also these ignoble goals.
So, you know,
their intention, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that for all universities right now, China and other places are very important for subsidizing the bottom line. There's a financial and a business goal. You know, we have huge, over 350,000, you know, Chinese students studying in the United States right now, paying full freight tuition, very much subsidizing, you know, the needs-based admissions policies at many of the leading universities. And, you know, these Chinese students who are really eager to come to China, to the United States and study at all levels, you know, everywhere from Harvard to, you know, Podunk University, you know, they're...
Well, that's
they're,
where I went.
That's where you live, Jeremy, right?
That's where I teach.
Goldcorn Holler, University Goldcorn Holler.
But, they're paying full tuition,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And it subsidizes the enterprise. I mean, there's a lot
and
of...
And this is in the U.S., but some of those people or the same demographic are also paying in China and in the Middle East.
Yeah,
I mean, those are where the schools are being set up, right? The two areas
with a lot of high
net worth individuals.
But to have a presence and a brand name in China, you know, is important in terms of attracting students to your home university. And that's one angle. And the other is there's a huge amount of high net worth in the Middle East where these places are set up and increasingly in China. China has, you know, a lot of more billionaires these days, if, you know, you believe the Hurunda report and all that stuff. So, you know, and there's a lot of high net worth there, you know, parents of students is the target for fundraising, alums who go back, who, you know, can give to the university and help subsidize that bottom line. So there's a huge financial angle on this.
And is it working? Are they making money and getting grants and, you know, is the model working?
I don't think so. You know, I just think that if they're going to exist, they need to be subsidized by the home university.
Or by a billionaire.
Yeah, or by a billionaire. But I mean, I'm talking about the independent centers,
right?
I don't think any of them are really going to be in existence 5 years from now because they have this pressure to kind of, fund their bottom line, their salary and rents and stuff. It's easy to raise money for the bricks and mortars when you're setting it up among alums and stuff. But then the daily operations, you know, who's going to pay for that? Who wants to pay for it? It's not very sexy. People want to pay for, you know, for the programs, and those are at the home university. They'd rather give to the home university. So there isn't a strong, I think, clarity, between the revenue sharing models or the cost sharing models. So these things are supported by the universities, you know, and the ones that have the business schools involved, I think they do better because they at least have some contribution to the bottom line from these exec ed programs from the business school. The ones without the business school, it's just like a freebie space. You can maybe charge for space, but it's never going to be enough to really bring in enough money to subsidize operations in an expensive place like China. So I think, you know, they have to be... it depends on the business plan, the business license. And I think there's been some evolution kind of in the Me Too versions of them among the centers. But ultimately, it's hard to raise money to support the bottom line after the place is in existence for a few years.
And just as a pure branding kind of cost center, is it you don't think it's worth it?
They have value. You know, I think they become more and more like a platform for the university to engage to market itself globally as well as engage globally with academics and others, policymakers on important global issues like urbanization or the environment or other things. All these centers, though, are working on kind of similar sets of issues. So, you know, there might be more efficiency by more collaboration, but then that doesn't promote the individual brands. I think there's still a lot of thinking that has to go into what are these centers for and what's the business model that's going to make them work. The model I was operating under was a money-losing model. It was very hard to raise money, and there wasn't a lot of clarity. I'd say on revenue sharing at campus, I often felt like I was competing with the schools or, you know, with the development office or something, or the area centers for raising money, you know, for the Beijing Center. So, you know, if in the current climate, I would say, and in the current with the current business models, it's hard for me to imagine that any of these places are going to be in existence in 5 years, you know, unless they really get, you know, different parts of the university to buy in and help subsidize the thing. The money has to come, you know, from campus. There has to be more subsidization of the existence of these things. So,
and, you know, that's where there's a basic problem, of course, because, you know, the space for free expression, as we're all very much aware, is contracting. I mean, Jeremy and I were on our way over here. We were talking about this phrase that I used to try to popularize, the new truculence, you know, I talk about. And I was saying, you know, Kaiser, you don't really use this anymore. And I said, well, yeah, because, you know, it's now not new. Well, Jeremy said, it's not new. I said, yeah, it's just the truculence. It's no longer the new truculence. But anyway, there have been, you know, restrictions on teaching so-called universal values, for instance, and even, you know, bans on foreign textbooks. This is impacting university programs now. You're somebody who's seen China move through different cycles of loosening and tightening over the last, 35 years or so. And I want to get your sense of what things look like maybe in the longer trajectory.
Yeah, well, I've been working in China for, you know, I hate to say 37 years, right? It makes me feel really old. I started working there when I was about 3 years old.
Right.
But, you know, I've kind of seen it all. You know, I've been through lots of retractions and relaxations, you know, after the Steve Mosier thing, all the kind of constraints on social science research that were put in place, the spiritual pollution campaign, China can just say no, you know, a lot of different things. But I've always kind of felt it was moving forward, you know, there would be these kind of,
3 steps forward, 2 steps back.
Yeah, right, something like that, you know, just it kind of was a continuous move forward in a positive way. I felt fairly optimistic that it was more open. But I have to honestly say I felt less so in the last few years. But the starting point is really different because it's a really open place now in ways that can't even compare to where it was before because of the internet and so many people who've studied abroad and come back, people who do international business. So, you know, I kind of say the genie's out of the bottle and I don't think you're going to put it back in there. And, you know, for so many Chinese...
Not for want of trying.
Not for lack of trying, right. But for so many sort of Chinese academics, the people that I work with a lot in my life, they're just like me, you know, they care about the same issues, they're open and forward-looking, their viewpoint is going to be changed by ideological rectification campaigns at this point in history about their, you know, views about the West or the views about the world. And I think they just know how to navigate in their system. And I think it's an extremely difficult time to have to navigate. There's a lot going down, might change after, you know, the 19th Party Congress. But for the moment, it's been in the last several years, it's been a very, very much more restrictive backward-heading environment, that's for sure.
No question about that.
I really appreciate, you know, the idea that, I mean, things are so much more open. It's incomparable to when you first
arrived.
I mean, even, you know, my early experiences in media in the 90s in China, working with women's magazines, it was still controversial to have makeup and, you know, miniskirts. You know, it was a kind of a political issue. I mean, young Chinese people don't know that or can scarcely believe it. So, I mean, you are talking about this huge change. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, this illiberal environment of the last few years must have a direct effect on the American campuses in China.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, first of all, I think, you know, you have to understand how these places are sort of set up. You know, there are the joint branch campus programs like the NYU's and the Duke Kunshan's, you know, they actually have a Chinese partner. And those places are, you know, I think those are relatively protected by their Chinese partner because They want them there, and they run interference for them in the system. The independent centers, you know, I think are a little bit more at risk. First of all, because, you know, they're trying to be there supporting their own bottom lines, which has become harder and harder in this political environment, because are you allowed to fundraise? Are you, you know, can you do any kind of academic program that may be more, you know, on a sensitive issue? Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things. So I think the constraints are certainly there. Absolutely, they're being more cautious. I think there is a climate of fear. Certainly when the draft of the NGO law came out, there was a kind of a huge step back. Like, first of all, does this law apply to the academic centers at all? I didn't think it did. I flagged to the university I was working with that this law was out there. I felt it was important for them to know that this law that was going to govern organizations that were not-for-profit outside of China, which universities mostly are, right? Even if they were registered as these for-profit consulting companies in China, the WFOEs, which most of the centers are, that it was going to affect us because of our, you know, kind of our legal status, but that it wasn't about the academic centers at all. In fact, they were later carved out. It really wasn't about the academic centers, but it you know, created this huge sense of fear, I think, about the place at the table for these programs in China, especially the ones that didn't have an official university partner that was going to run interference for them.
So and, how did that manifest itself? Were they canceling programs? Were they
in my case, yes, they did. My particular university was, you know, really got very paranoid, I would say, and felt very much like we were at risk, and rightly or wrongly, you know, and for a variety of reasons, you know, felt that the center itself was at risk and started canceling programs.
We've never encountered anything like that.
But, you know, what I was doing, I mean, the particular circumstances was that I had worked with the Ford Foundation on women's rights issues right after the Beijing Women's Conference. And I had huge connections in the world of, you know, the China feminist community, uh-huh. the domestic violence network, lots of, you know, organizations working on women's rights issues. So, you know, the center had a grant to do a series of events on Beijing Plus 20, the 20th anniversary of the Beijing Women's Movement.
Uh-huh. And, in 2015 now, right?
Yeah, that was in 2015. And after the Feminist Five were arrested and detained, I think, you know, the university mistakenly thought that all women's rights issues were sensitive in China. And, you know, the Feminist Five wasn't really about that. It was about cross-city organizing and whatever. But
right. Let's put a pin in that. Yeah. Jeremy, quickly ID Feminist Five for our listeners.
So five feminists who were organizing to mount demonstrations about various feminist causes.
Sexual harassment primarily.
Sexual harassment on public transportation.
Terribly controversial topic.
And detained. And apparently some of them, you know, until this day, harassed and intimidated.
Yes.
Yeah.
And why? I mean,
so then all our events on
you said it was cross-city organization. That was the problem that you think
yeah,
was,
I think they were arrested because they were young activists.
They were organizing.
Yeah. Right. It wasn't about, you know, academic discourse in a university center or even any academic discourse, which is rarely ever constrained in China, in my opinion. But our events at the center were canceled.
Was this all the way up from you know, Mr. Lee Bollinger?
You know, who knows?
We don't really know.
In the end, I mean, it was certainly represented as the senior leadership to me, but was it communicated to me by the senior leadership? No.
That's a very China story.
We had to, you know, submit a pipeline of our upcoming events, and you know, the ones that were deemed too sensitive were canceled. And that, you know, that for me was like a Rubicon. After all I've done in China over the years, my big question was, why are we here, right? If we're not going to be talking about, you know, about these issues honestly and openly in an academic environment.
Jeremy, did you listen to the Eric Fish podcast for the Asia Society? You heard it, right, Joan?
Yeah, I did. I thought it was absolutely fabulous.
It was great. Oh my God, it was some of the best radio reporting that I've come across. I mean, it's really it's excellent. So you know, it tackles this issue. It looks specifically at the NYU Shanghai program and really interviews this really wide gamut of people on different sides of the issue. I think he does an extraordinarily fair and balanced job of looking at, you know, this very thorny issue. Sorry, Jeremy, you were about to...
Yeah, it's just, John, you'd earlier, you said that you thought that Duke, Kunshan, and NYU Shanghai, because they had local government partners, actually had a certain amount of protection. But I find that interesting, because my sense of working in China with foreign companies and entities that work with a local partner is that they often become more cautious and self-censor to a greater degree, because you start being like Chinese people. You have something invested. Mr. Wang is not just Mr. Wang. He's your colleague, Mr. Wang, that you get to know. And you don't want Mr. Wang to get in trouble. Therefore, you cancel your lecture on, you know, corruption in the Communist Party, for example.
And there's no point waiting around for Mr. White.
I mean, is that not what happens when there's a local government partner? Do you think that they
I don't think so. First of all, I think, you know, for these you know, I thought Jeff Lehman was fabulous about this on the Eric Fish, you know, podcast. I think that, you know, that the principle of academic freedom has been reiterated, and there's a lot of home faculty opposition to these things. And I think, you know, the core values of the university, you know, it's a slippery slope. You really need to preserve the core value of the universities. And I don't think there has been a lot of real in the classroom censorship, you know, at all in any of these programs. I think the way it happens is more subtle in a way. It's like what programs are allowed to, you know, what happened in the first place. Like if you're going to do a program on law and with lawyers who were challenging the government on some issues related to rights or procedure, something like that, or detentions, would NYU actually let that program happen, you know, in the first place? Once the thing was approved and happens, I don't think there's any restriction
in the classroom.
In the classroom, right. Yeah. I think that was reflected in that, you know,
in that podcast.
I think that it's a kind of subtle directing activities that has happens at a, you know, three steps before in a way.
So right. How should these foreign universities and these foreign programs, especially American programs, be thinking about the NGO law? Is there more danger right now than in them being too cautious or too cavalier?
Well, you know, frankly, I think it's the danger is in being too cautious. Mm. But, you know, I've always been kind of an optimist and a kind of a boundary pusher person in China in some ways. You know, I think there's plenty of room, yeah, and plenty of partners in China who the NGO world is here to stay. I mean, it's not like it's the same thing. The genie's out of the bottle. You know, for the last 20 years, you've had a very, very active civil society space. And some issues, the issues I've worked on HIV/AIDS, I've done a lot of work in that area. You know, the government is totally bought in on the important role, essential role of these organizations in things like reaching out to communities of people living with AIDS and other things like that. You know, so the NGO sector is not going to go away. The government partners and the environment's another area where, you know, you've got really these very important actors who've been operating in collaboration with government for a long period of time. And those partners will continue to make it happen. And I think, therefore, not being too cautious is important. It's a time, many of my kind of closest colleagues who work on these issues see it as a time of opportunity in a way. I mean, it's opportunity in a very much more restricted way than it was, say, 5 years ago or 10 years ago. But I think it will build again very quickly. You know, there are only about 100 organizations have registered so far under this foreign NGO law. But I think you're going to see the pace, you know, quicken. And I think there's kind of a co-creation opportunity here. Some of my closest colleagues use that, you know, kind of analogy in a way to, not analogy, but, you know, phrase, sure, to describe the opportunity right now. China's always been a little bit Wild West, as you know,
sure,
you know, where you kind of make it, you create it as you go, and yeah, there's a lot of opportunity.
Ask for forgiveness instead of asking for permission.
Right? Yeah, yeah. And I think in this space, there's an openness to by people who want to have this sector you know, continue and the foreign actors be involved in it to try to find ways to make it happen in a positive way.
Doesn't it also depend on what the organization does? I mean, absolutely. So, you know, educational Ivy League schools are going to be okay because China loves them. If you're solving health issues, it's going to be okay. But if you are maybe the American Bar Association, I don't know if they've registered. I mean, if you're working on legal issues, isn't that going to just be very, very, very tough?
Well, yes, absolutely. Because, you know, if you just go back to why this law is in place in the first place, it's really to try to control and create a more transparent structure where who's funding what in China, especially related to any kind of political organizing that may challenge the party. I mean,
that's what it's for.
There's a suite of, you know, new security legislation that all has come out around the same time. And, you know, the fact that the Public Security Bureau, rather than the Ministry of Civil Affairs, is in charge of the foreign NGO says it all, right?
Right.
It used to be the Ministry of Civil Affairs and things were progressing towards a less regulatory environment. It's now with the Public Security Bureau and the regulations are clearly being articulated, especially to create more transparency in who's funding what. And for those areas of that the government is concerned about that, you know, will potentially lead to anti-party organizing, you know, they're not going to easily find partners and be able to do what they've done or been doing, right?
And are certain funders going to be targeted? I mean, like, say, if the N, the National
Endowment for Democracy,
the NDA,
the
non-disclosure agreement. Will the National Endowment for Democracy, for example, be kind of blacklisted, or the Soros, you know, Open Society? Are those going to be more difficult than the
you
Ford
know,
Foundation?
I don't know if they're going to be blacklisted, you know. And I think it's important to kind of look at what's going on. And yeah. I mean, they're, you know, I think they're going to have a hard time finding, you know, a sponsoring organization, a PSU, a primary professional supervisory organization, which is the mechanism by which an NGO, foreign NGO, can register in the country. You know, people will stay away from these organizations that they consider to be, if not officially blacklisted, you know,
slightly toxic
or somewhat suspect. And, you know, the same thing sort of going on in Russia and India, Turkey, a lot of other places in the world right now. It's not kind of unique to China, but in China, I think, you know, it's fairly well organized. Now, on the PSU thing, the professional supervisory unit, I mean, this isn't a new thing either. You know, I've been around the NGO sector in China for a long time. And in the 90s, when I was with the Ford Foundation, you know, Ford was very involved in helping kind of support, you know, the emerging civil society actors in a lot of different areas. You know, even with the Ministry of Civil Affairs, there was this dual management system where you had to find a kind of mother-in-law organization, a Guakao Danwe, you know, that would take you on and be responsible for you politically and some degree financially, right? And so this is not a new thing, this professional supervisory unit. It's just the organizations they're government organization. It's not the Ministry of Civil Affairs. It's not about building and enabling the sector as much as it was previously. Now it's more about controlling and creating transparency of the sector, you know.
And so what would you advise the administration of one of these organizations that's coming in? They don't have that kind of on the ground knowledge. They don't, I mean, you know, you and people who have been around the block for whom this is not the first rodeo, who, you know, the subtleties of this, you can sort of feel the subtle shifts of the wind, but it's sort of hard to form policy just based on that, right? I mean, would you just say, look, you got to trust the people you have on the ground. You have to sort of trust the people who have that experience and that sensensitivity to it?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I think you have to trust the people you have on the ground. I mean, that certainly wasn't my experience recently. And I think it was wrong. I think a lot of the organizations outside of China don't understand China that well and how to operate in China and may or may not have, you know, faculty steering committees or other types of governance structures or faculty who they can, you know, who have more experience in China, they can consult. But I think you have to trust people who've been on the ground and have worked in China. China's a fairly predictable place in a lot of ways. And I think and if you're trusted and if you're considered sort of a friend of China and you have experience working on the ground, and you have a number of high level contacts and things like that, you know, you can navigate the system
right,
to some degree. I mean, you guys know that, right?
Yeah. I mean, because it's the same thing that is true of this. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the conundrum that so many people face right now, whether you're an internet company, you know, whether you're Google contemplating an exit or Facebook contemplating an entry, whether, you know, you're a publisher, you're a writer and you're wondering whether you want your book translated into Chinese. There's this sort of compromise you have to make. And there's this calculus that we all have to perform of, is that compromise worth the change that we think that we might be able to affect, or the mm-hmm. good that we might be able to do. Yeah.
The other thing I think that's really important is that, you know, laws are laws, but in China, you know, the laws are not, you know, the law isn't always. You know, it's not the ultimate broker of, you know, what's going to happen. If, right. You know, if they're out to get you, they're going to get you, whether or not, you know, they'll use the law. But if not, you know,
they'll make up a law. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like, it's the law is kind of, it's almost like it's out there as a kind of a, you know,
it's a tool for doing things that sometimes you have to worry about and sometimes you don't.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, wise
I mean,
words.
You know, I think where Kaiser was going for that is, you know, and I think, I mean, this is a question that's very interesting to you for sure, and Kaiser and me, because we've had to make these kind of decisions. How far is too far? You know, there's a troll on the internet that thinks Kaiser has stained his immortal soul by working for Baidu, which I completely disagree with. But, you know, for that's him, just working friend, for Baidu, that was enough to, you know, condemn Kaiser to
the worst, you know, the worst circle,
you know, the seventh circle, whatever. You know, I think that's ridiculous. But, you know, some of the things I've worked on, I wonder, you know, where's the line?
I think you're pretty clean.
No, I think, you know, you know, what you mean, what's the line in terms of compromising your values? Or, yeah. I think, you know when you get there, right? And, you know, for the...
Like pornography.
So I have an expression I use for, you know, when people say it's a slippery slope, I'll slip down that slope when I get to it.
I mean, you know, I think if you feel like you're contributing to, you know, social betterment in some way, at least for me, the calculus has always been, do I have colleagues who I can work with, who are the champions of these issues in China, whom I can facilitate or assist and work with to move forward an important socialist issue like domestic violence or, you know, the AIDS response.
You said socialist issue.
Yeah, I'm a social do-gooder, you know, whatever. But, you know, I think you just, you know, if you don't feel like you're contributing, but you feel like you're compromising your core values, or you're aiding and abetting something that you think is something you don't, you know, you really don't believe in and don't want to have happen, that's your Rubicon, right? I mean, a Rubicon for me is whether, well, how much do I self-censor on issues that I, first of all, that I don't think are sensitive and I think are important, and where there are champions in China who are trying to move these issues forward. And I always, always respect my Chinese colleagues to tell me where the line is and the boundary of safety in all ways for them. They're the ones at risk. I mean, I'm not at risk, you know.
We don't have the skin in the game that our Chinese colleagues
that's
do.
That's for sure.
We should always remember
it's
that.
It's one of the reasons why people who are highly judgmental, Westerners who are highly judgmental about these issues, annoy us, both Kaiser and me, for sure. Joan, we're going to run out of time, and we have to talk about the Schwarzman Scholars Program, because we believe that all of our listeners in their 20s are very, very smart and should apply for the program. So can you tell us about it?
Yeah, this is your chance to make a pitch and get some
good
applicants.
Absolutely. Well, we are seeking future global leaders. And those of you who think you may be that person, apply to the Schwarzman Scholars Program. We're a fabulous new 1 year master's in global affairs with a focus on China, a focus on leadership, and it's highly selective, but we recruit globally. The age range is 22 to 28, and we're looking for people who are interested in trying to be a bridge in the next decades between China and the rest of the world. Young future global leaders who are interested in spending a year in China at Tsinghua University in this new 1 year fully funded master's degree program,
Fully funded means like your airplane ticket, your food, everything, books, the whole deal. Wow.
The whole deal. Right. In a beautiful new building on Tsinghua campus.
Unfettered internet.
Yeah.
Filtered air. Yeah. A gym. What else? Like,
with future Chinese global leaders and other leaders from around the world. And, you know, in a very intense residential college cohort experience. We're just about to graduate our first class. We're recruiting for year three right now. We have 129 incoming scholars next year, 110 graduating, and we're actively recruiting. So go to our website.
Schwarzmanscholars.org.
Right?
Let's spell that S-C-H-W-A-R-Z-M-A-N. Scholars.org.
Absolutely. And tell them Seneca sent you.
Right. And we have fabulous people teaching in the program and coming and speaking at the in the program. And it's a, you know, it's a wonderful, wonderful Tsinghua University experience.
It's up in the northeast corner of it, right?
Yes, it is.
So it's a fairly new area. I mean, that was sort of the wilds of old
Tsinghua.
Yeah,
it's where all the sort of sports fields, the swimming pool, everything is. And it's you know, it's great. I urge you to apply if you're interested.
Yeah, no, it looks just fantastic. I just wish I were younger. Well, I wish I were younger for many other reasons, too, but... that's terrific.
You know, Joan, me too.
Yeah, me too.
Very wise words from Joan, though, today. I mean, Joan, so thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us. And stick around. Let's make some recommendations for our listeners. Yeah?
Yeah.
All right. So before we get to recommendations, I want to remind our listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SUP China. Check out the app and subscribe to the newsletter at supchina.com. You can follow SUP China on Twitter at SUP China News and on Facebook at Facebook.com/SUPChinaNews. If you like the Seneca podcast, by all means, leave us a positive review on the Apple iTunes Store or on Google Play or any of the podcast catchers, as they call them, wherever it is that you go to review apps. This really helps. It means a whole ton to us. And on to recommendations. Jeremy, kick us off. What do you got?
Okay, firstly, just in terms of feedback, if you ever want to give us feedback, don't hesitate to write to jeremy@supchina.com or kaiser@supchina.com or anyone who works with us, just use their first name. But my recommendation for today is Kishore Mahbubani, who is a former senior diplomat. I think he was even had a vice foreign minister.
He was
foreign
minister
at one point.
Taught at Schwarzman College. He did.
So from Singapore. And yeah. I think he's one of the most interesting thinkers on China and China and America and China and its relationship with the rest of the world. And I don't agree with everything he says, but some things I find he makes a lot of sense, and he's always interesting to read. So the story I'd like to, the article I'd like to recommend is something he had in the Huffington Post, and it's titled "It's a Problem That America Is Still Unable to Admit It Will Become Number Two to China. This is Partly Why Trump Happened." So, you know, you may not agree with it, but it's a good read.
Yeah, actually, I referred to that piece a couple times in something that I had written recently about Belt and Road. You know, it's an excellent piece. Contentious. Yeah. And I mean, he doesn't pull punches. The guy, he's an interesting guy. He's, you know, kind of an LKY protege. Smart guy.
Yeah, he gave a talk, taught in class at Schwarzman College this year. Just a representation of our fabulous guest lecturers and faculty.
Joe Nye, who was on our podcast recently.
Joe Nye was on. We had Joe Nye. Many of your guests, Susan Shirk, have been. Yeah, you're just gonna
run through our guest list and then you invite them to Schwarzman.
Absolutely.
See how this works now.
Well, we have to get you guys there.
Yeah, get us there, really, and we'll do a live podcast. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We'd be psyched to do that. Absolutely. Yeah. So, Joan, what do you have for us?
Well, apropos of today's topic, I thought I would recommend the Asia Society China Files new China NGO project, China Files NGO project, which was launched on June 7th. This is a fabulous website. It's got five sections, including a kind of latest updates from the editors, facts, laws and regulations, links and media and resources, including Ask an Expert for all those people out there who are trying to figure out how to navigate the new foreign NGO law in China. It's fabulous. It's really fabulous. And I provided a huge, my trove of documents that I collect on all this stuff. I think it's going to be an absolutely wonderful resource in this domain. It's just an information and kind of service site, I would say. for people trying to figure stuff out.
I am such a fan of Chinafile. I mean, I think what Susie and John
are it's doing great.
It's just so great. It's so-
And what is the URL? Is it, can you find it at the Chinafile.com
homepage?
Yeah,
you just go to Asia Society and go to Chinafile. There's a link to the – it's called Chinafile's NGO project. Okay. And it really just launched. And I've sent – I can't tell you how many people I've sent there already to ask an expert and other things who've asked me, you know – you know, how do you get a temporary activities permit and that kind of stuff? Do I need one?
Oh, what a great, great recommendation. Yeah. I think many of our listeners are going to find it very useful. Excellent. So I want to make a belated recommendation for the podcast Hi-Fi Nation from Barry Lamb. Barry, who's become a friend of mine now, he's a Vassar philosophy professor. He took a year at Duke at this excellent program where he produced the podcast. And, you know, I had lunch with a couple times. He came over to a party. Great guy. Really, really good podcast. I mean, it's amazing. It's a very nicely produced kind of radio magazine style podcast. It looks at real world situations kind of through the lens of philosophy. He is an academic philosopher, but you know, he doesn't come off that way, at all. I've wanted to plug it for some time now. And then one night I happened to be awake at like 2 a.m. and Overcast, my personal favorite podcast app that Jeremy introduced me to, informed me that Slate Culture podcast, another podcast I like, had dropped. And to my amazement, they were reviewing his podcast. This one, it was, you know, getting a few hundred downloads, and now it's like ranking very, very high, and it's doing really well, really much deserved. Slate gave him, you know, six thumbs up. His subscriptions have just gone nuts, and you'll really enjoy it. There's this one where he interviews Errol Morris, the filmmaker, the documentary filmmaker who made Fog of War and other things, Thin Blue Line, where he does this massive takedown of Thomas Kuhn, you know, the guy who wrote Structures of Scientific Revolution, which is a book I thoroughly hate. So it's a great podcast. You'll really enjoy it. Joni, thanks again. It was so good to see you.
Yeah, thanks for having me do this. I've really enjoyed it, and I'm a huge fan of the Seneca podcast.
You don't need to say that. We love you. Anyway, the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn. Thanks also to Adla Cheng and Soraya Darabi from SubChina. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com. Visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/Seneca Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Seneca Podcast. You know, as Jeremy said, drop us an email. Really do. I mean, we love to hear from you guys. Tell us what we could be doing better. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week. Take care.